Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, Monday, the 10th of August. And very nice to have you with us on the program this morning. I hope you had a beautiful weekend and enjoyed it in whatever way you like to enjoy things. We have a lot to talk about this morning and a wonderful panel to do so. I remind you that you can always join us and weigh in on this on the topics that we discuss, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the gang to you this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Big Joe. It was wonderful to talk to you. I'm raring to go.
Excellent. We'll get going. We also welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm raring to go, too.
Excellent. Good to go. And publisher emeritus of the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. That's it. Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I haven't been raring to go since 1974, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, you can play it off, Ira. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Libby Post is on the show, political consultant, lobbyist, our good friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. I can drive now, so I'm very, very happy.
I saw the picture of your keys. You looked looked downright ebullient.
Yes, very happy.
Yeah, well, good for you.
Thank you.
For those of you wondering if like Libby had lost her license due to some sort of infraction, no, she she's finally off probation, ladies and gentlemen. No, she had a new shoulder put in, and now she can drive. So that's good. That means you've been very good with your PT.
I have been very, very good.
All right. Well, let's get to the story. We don't often do this, but I would like to do it today where we start off with a I just say this is a regional story. It is a regional story, but it's also a national story because we're talking about the House of Representatives. And we're also talking about one of the closely watched primaries in the country. This is the Alex Morse versus Representative Richard Neal, the incumbent Democrat. So this from the Washington Post: as other left-wing congressional candidates racked up wins around the country, Alex Morse, 31 years old, seemed like he could become the next liberal challenger to oust a long-term incumbent. Morse, the country's youngest openly gay mayor, spoke eloquently about growing up in working class in Holyoke, Massachusetts, losing his brother to a heroin addiction earlier this year. Representative Richard Neal has been in office for 3 decades, the mayor said, but failed in recent years to make himself visible in his rural and industrial swath of the state. But as allegations emerged that Morse had used his position to make advances on men a decade his junior, he offered an admission on Sunday he had in fact engaged in relationships with local college students. In an apology Sunday night, Morse, who also taught college courses for a time, refused to drop out of the race. His sexual orientation had unfairly heightened the focus on his personal life while denying any accusations of non-consensual relationship. He says, "I say this not to shirk responsibility for having made anyone uncomfortable. I am simply highlighting the fact that I am being held to a different standard, one deeply connected to a history of surveilling the sex lives of people like me." Libby, I hope you don't mind if I go to you first.
This is such a double-edged sword. You know, everybody has the right to consensual sexual activity in their lives. However, this man is a public official, was a lecturer, should have known better. He just should have known better than to have sexual encounters with folks that could possibly be his students, were his students. I don't care if he met them on Grindr or whatever other app he used. It's inappropriate when you are in a position as a professor, and I am one. You know, I'm an adjunct at SUNY Albany, and I just think it's inappropriate. And, you know, we've railed against, and we will continue to rail against, the inequality of male teachers hitting up on female students.
Yes.
you know, and sexual assault on campus and all the things that we all know that happens on campus. And just because one is part of the LGBTQ community doesn't mean that you should live at a different standard. You have a responsibility to students. You have a responsibility to the higher education institution. And as mayor, you have a responsibility to your constituents and the taxpayers. And that responsibility is to act responsibly. And I'm sure there are going to be people in the community who are going to, like, be very unhappy with me. But, you know, I've been around the block a few times, and I've watched this happen to many, many people. I remember when the, you know, it was the majority leader or the speaker in the Massachusetts House, his partner was the one who was being sexually active and acting like a predator. I'm not saying this guy is a predator in any way. But, you know, and he lost, the elected official lost his position. You know, there has to be some standards. Just because we have what we have in the White House, just because the Orange Menace, you know, boasts about grabbing women's genitals and is being sued and is, it could very well go down in some other sexual cases, sexual assault cases, that doesn't mean that everybody else can act that way too. We have to live at to a higher standard.
So let me, I want to get Alan in on this, but I'm also interested in this idea that, so it was the college Democrats who came out and wrote a letter and said that they no longer wanted him at their events because they felt uncomfortable with him around. All of the statement, there was an initial statement and then there was the written statement that he made yesterday. None of those statements seem to address that fact that students are uncomfortable. And there seems to be, you mentioned, well, I said this in reading a part of the Post article talking about a double standard, but he seems to be making an issue out of the fact that these students have not come forward and that they are anonymous, which that doesn't seem to be right either, does it, Libby? I mean, they shouldn't have to, correct?
No, they shouldn't have to. I mean, you know, we saw what happened. I can't remember her name right now, to the woman who came forward and challenged Brett Kavanaugh. We saw what happened to Anita Hill.
Kristen Blasey Ford, came, yes.
Right, right. And we saw what happened to Anita Hill when she challenged Clarence Thomas and his Supreme Court nomination. We see what happens when people come forward. They are victimized even further. So I understand why students wouldn't want to come forward. It's a very, especially if you're 20, 22 years old. I mean, come on. Nobody's used to dealing with that. Nobody should ever have to deal with this kind of situation. But then you have all the peer issues that go along with it. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that this did happen. He's admitted to it. And, you know, he needs to do some work to regain the public's trust.
So there's a lot of issues here, Alan. One, of course, is there are some on the city council in Holyoke who are calling for him to resign as mayor. So that's one issue. The other is the decision that he has made already to stay in the race. So there's that. And then there are the people in the congressional district who now look at the choice between Alex Morse and Richard Neal and have a decision to make on Election Day.
That's all true, Joe. A couple of things that I'd like to say. First of all, you know, I have great respect for the Washington Post, but I think they're wrong. I don't think Alex Morse was going to knock off Richie Neal. Richie Neal, who wrote all of the major legislation that gave $600 to every American and everybody else. I mean, it wasn't going to happen, and I know that it was not going to happen. Let's leave it at that. So I think the Post is wrong in implying that that was what was at stake here. It was not. Now, I feel great empathy for Morse. I do. He's a guy who's come from a very rough sort of family circumstance and the rest of it. And I think Libby was spot on in virtually everything she said and also spoke from a position of great courage. As far as I'm concerned, that's why we love Libby and why it's so important that she's with us. But, you know, he's not going to resign as mayor. Two city councilmen said he should resign. He'll try to tough it through. He had a choice. He could drop out, but his name was already on the ballot, or he could go forward. If he goes forward, he has a better chance of staying in the game, I suspect, although I don't think this is going to do him any good. He tried in his statement, I think, and I'd love to know what Libby thinks, to suggest that this was a matter of anti-gayism, but it wasn't. It wasn't. I don't think anybody stopped him from being mayor because he was gay or running for office because he was gay. I don't even know if it would have helped him a little bit. But this is a very different circumstance. I feel bad for the guy. I truly do.
Libby?
Yeah, I feel bad for him too. You know, I mean, this is a, without being too graphic, I mean, you know, men have a problem at times with controlling their, keeping it in their pants is the best way that I can put it. Oh. And that becomes a priority over doing their jobs. And it's really too bad because a lot of good legislators, a lot of good elected officials have been brought down because of sexual scandals. And it's like, enough already. Can't you learn? This has been going on for centuries. Can't people learn? Can't folks learn already that this is not the way to behave if you want to be an elected official? Yes, I know this, the example in the White House gives everybody license to be as onerous and horrible as they want to be, but this guy's a Dem. This guy calls himself progressive.
Right.
You know, let's have some respect for individuals and have some respect for younger people who shouldn't be put in a position where a professor ends up being the person you're looking at on Grindr or whatever the dating app was.
You know,
Joe, one last thing, and that is from a political perspective, as you probably know, I walk my 4 miles every morning starting at 5:30. And I go by three or four houses that have more signs up. They're still up.
Well, probably a lot of people want to see how this plays out, right? I mean, I think, you know, he made a statement last night. It was the first major statement that he'd made. I'm also interested. I want to bring the rest of the group in on this too. But Libby, the other thing here, well, Libby and Alan, but you, Morris has made he is saying in his statement that he wants to make it known that these were consensual relationships, that they were consensual relationships, and also that he had not broken any rules of UMass Amherst, where he was a lecturer for seven semesters, I believe, over the last several years. So, but my question is, that still means that if you were the mayor of Holyoke, you are a known lecturer and professor at a college, and you go to a college Democratic event, that may not be a student-teacher relationship, but it's still, and I can come up with no other word than creepy, of having this guy using this not only to advance his political career, but also his romantic life.
Please go ahead, Libby.
As a political consultant, okay, this is like the biggest nightmare any candidate can ever bring upon themselves.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is he brought it upon himself. He should know better. He should find a stable relationship. I mean, I hate to put it this way, but come on. You're an elected official. This is, you should want to live up to, as a Democrat, as a progressive Democrat who's an elected official, you should want to live up to a higher standard to show what it means to be a progressive Democrat.
Alan.
I mean, maybe I'm being old-fashioned. I don't know.
Well, you know, I have no problem with his having other partners if that's what he wants to do. You and I don't, but he might want to. But not selecting them from students. You know, this guy has basically admitted, if you read the statement, and I hope everybody will, if you read the statement, it goes on for a long time. He says he did it. He says he would understand it if people wanted to withdraw their endorsements from him.
Right.
He is basically.
Well, he says he had, in fact, engaged in relationships with local college students. That he has said that. Yes.
Right, but it's more than that. It is that he is basically admitting, yes, you're right, but he's basically admitting that he did things that he shouldn't be proud of and that people might find objectionable.
Yes.
But at the same time he's saying that, and this is what really sort of got me, he's saying, playing the gay card. And that's why I'm so glad Libby is with us this morning, because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't misreading this, but you can't have it both ways. You can't say I did wrong and also say, but they're after me because I'm gay, and straight people get away with this all the time. I'm sure that's true. And I'm sure it's also true that not only do gay people get away with it, straight people, but gay people get away with it. So it really makes no sense to me.
Well, I have to say, there's a new headline that just broke on the New York Times about a straight person, Steve Easterbrook, who was the McDonald's former CEO, and McDonald's is suing him because he had concealed evidence of sexual relationships with three employees. So here we start to see corporate America saying no to this kind of behavior as well.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to our other two wonderful panelists, Jennifer Burns and Ira Fussfeld. We will also take your letters. We have a few of those, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Ira Fussfeld all joining us on this Monday morning. And again, we'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all with us. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jennifer Burns, and Ira Fussfeld. So we've been talking about this case of Alex Morse and Richard Neal and that race and the allegations that came out over the weekend. So Ira, let me allow you to weigh in, and we'll go to Jennifer, and then we'll go to the letters here.
Well, I'm tempted to defer to Libby and Alan because I was unaware of the story until when you read the introduction, but I'm catching up to it now during the break. And I think Alan just mentioned this, but the quote that jumps out at me from Morse is him saying that he's being held to a different standard, one deeply connected to a history of surveilling the sex lives of people like me. And that strikes me as incorrect. We all could take a yellow notepad and write down a list of politicians or would-be politicians who were not gay, who have been similarly exposed to, for want of a better word. So I thought Libby's comments initially are very responsible and make sense to me. But for once, I'm going to say I don't have a lot of insight into this one.
Jennifer?
Joe, if I could just very quickly say, this is a guy who has been elected mayor with everybody knowing he's gay in a fairly large city in Massachusetts. So it isn't as if, you know, this has been a constant thing held against him.
Right.
No, whatever it's worth. But there have been the history of exposing before modern gay rights movement, before what we've been able to accomplish, before, you know, in the 80s and the 70s, I remember there was a bathhouse in Albany was raided, and the Times Union at that point printed the names of the guys who were arrested. I mean, that kind of stuff is definitely what I think what the candidate is referring to, is that kind of, we can't have our own lives and, you know, we're going to be reported in the newspaper. But that doesn't happen as much anymore, at least not in major metropolitan areas.
On the other hand, we have Congress people who are gay and who are lauded and who are reelected every time, and they're out front about it. I think maybe, Libby, we've turned a corner. I hope so.
In some, you know, yes, on the both coasts, we've turned a corner. In major metropolitan areas, we've turned the corner. When you go into the, you know, what people call the Bible Belt, not so much.
Jennifer?
Not so much.
You are also a university lecturer. What do you make of this?
You know, I see a little bit of everything that everybody's saying. I think that there is a double standard. I mean, historically, heterosexual people involved in extramarital affairs or things like that in politics take a hit, but they recover. And whenever sexuality or homosexuality, LGBTQ issues become a part of the conversation, those who are not heterosexual end up facing a more difficult fallout, for sure, and far more, I would say, prejudiced and discriminatory attacks on the behavior. I mean, we see even sometimes in the evangelical community that when heterosexual men or women do this, that's time for them to repent and we'll save and we'll fix, right? It's part of the thinking over there, which does not really equate equally for people in the LGBT community historically. The other thing I think is that we need to separate the place and the people he participated in this with from his preference, we'll say, or, you know, who his partners are. Mm-hmm. Because crossing the line in his position, to me, is the biggest issue.
Right.
That right there, not who he does it with, but that he crossed that line.
Right.
I just don't think
right.
other people will focus on that. They will get lost in our culture that adds a negative and worse consequence for people who are not straight.
I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you, Jennifer, but it seems to me that many people will look at this for what it is of be concerned about, regardless of sexual preference, be concerned about the idea that you are having relationships with college students.
That right there, I think, is the biggest issue, crossing that line for any professional of any age. He's also 31 years old, and not to give him a pass on that, but we must look at where people who are in their later 20s and early 30s are in life with dating apps and with a different culture from some of us who are older and, you know, don't do that. So I'm not saying that gives him a pass on it, but people in their early 30s and in their 20s use those regularly rather than what the traditional ways were to go out and
going out on a date. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, are we saying that instead of a gay relationship here, the college student was a woman and it was a heterosexual affair, our analysis of Morse and his ability to be relevant and be a candidate would change?
Some of our analysis would. Some of us, yes. It would be a wink and a nod. And, oh, wow, yeah. Look at him. He's getting a younger chick. But let me just say something about the language. Let me just say something about the language we're using. It is not sexual preference, and I'm not lecturing anybody, but preference means I can choose. This is not a choice for me. It's a sexual orientation.
I apologize for that.
Not to worry. It's gender identity. Let's just be clear about that. Because really, when you say preference, it's like, oh, well, it's a choice. And that gets into the whole thing of, well, you could choose. And, well, no, I can't.
No, I know better, and I apologize.
Okay. That's all right.
Jennifer.
I love you anyway.
I love you,
yeah,
too.
But I do think if he was a 31-year-old man and this was happening with women, conversation would be very different. And that right there speaks to the different standard.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let's go to letters. We have quite a few, so let's get started. We go to John, who says, another reporting, I'm hearing that the UMass Democrats that broke the story are funded by Richie Neal. Regardless of whether or not Morse acted inappropriately, that is a separate issue. It is clear this is a political hit job by Neal and his organization. The college Democrats, I understand, came out with a statement last night. They received, I believe, $1,000. It's either $1,000 or $1,500 from Richie Neal. They also received money from just about every other Democratic elected official in the region. I don't know. They deny that this is any quid pro quo in any way, shape, or form. So take that for what it is. Alan, do you have anything else on that?
Yeah, when the writer says it is clear, it is not clear. And look, I've been nosing around trying to figure out what's going on here. And I think that the one thing you can say about Richie Neal's people, first of all, you know that I have great affection for Richie Neal. I just think he's wonderful. And that he's a kind and gentle man and a very bright man. I don't think he would have anything to do with this. That's my own feeling. I could say that it is clear, but based on the evidence, it is clear. And based on what I know about Richie Neal, this is not a Richie Neal hit job that is happening here. And in fact, when you look at it, the question is it true or isn't it true? It isn't whether, you know, somebody's out to get him in a campaign in which he's been throwing cherry bombs at Richie Neal for months now. It's a question of, did you do it or didn't you?
We go to Robin, who says, as a queer person, I find it awful that Alex Morse is being characterized as a predator in the news. He is young, single, and sexually active. He is 31 and not that much older than the people he is dating. Most people look in their circles for long-term or short-term partners. Nothing unusual here, gay or straight. To Libby's point, he should settle down is an antiquated notion. Okay.
I want you all to know that this story has hit Israel. It is on Haaretz, which is one of the dailies in Israel.
It's huge.
Because
yeah.
Morse is Jewish. Now it's made international news.
So, but again, to the point of Robin's letter, that being characterized as a predator and that he's young and he's single and he's sexually active, but again, going to Jennifer's point, but if you have students and college Democrats who wrote a letter and say, yes, but when he comes to our events, he makes us feel uncomfortable, is that not business as usual?
No, that is not. You know, that indicates to me that there's been some kind of behavior that they felt for sure was inappropriate. And I'm not butting any of this away. I think that the point here is that he, somewhere along the lines, he has crossed the line enough in his dating, not paying attention to his position as an instructor or a professor, but also now, you know, as the mayor, that there are certain places that you cannot date, no matter what your age is, when you're, you know, you just can't.
Yeah.
So that for me is the bigger line, the biggest line crosser.
I agree.
Now, I don't want to say he's a predator. I mean, because I don't know that. But when you're in a position of power like that as an instructor or somebody, you absolutely know you should not be crossing that line, no matter what age you are.
I want to go to Betsy's letter. It says, I couldn't disagree more. Having consensual gay sexual relationships can be construed as predatory. Really? Your homophobia is showing, and yes, Morse was a threat to Neil, at least before this happened. Plus, don't you think this is a bit too convenient timing-wise? Why are there no specific individuals' names not given that have come forward? I think this is basically Massachusetts Dems who don't like to upset a powerful, powerful man playing dirty politics. And because a gay man has sex isn't a crime, and Libby was wrong to promulgate that awful trope that gay men are mostly promiscuous.
I didn't hear her say that gay men are mostly promiscuous. Did you say that, Libby?
No.
Where does that come from?
I know Libby said men in general have long time.
Well, that was the keep it in your pants line. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Right,
yeah. Which, for all men.
Sorry if I offended anybody.
But I hate it when somebody writes a letter and says that I said something that I didn't say or that you said something you didn't say. You didn't say that. You didn't say that.
My problem with this, if he wants to go on Grindr and have an active sex life, that's fine. Not with students. Not when you're a professor. It's just that simple.
And by the way, the university has now spoken out on this, and powerfully. And I think a lot of the newspaper articles I've been seeing do not mention that. The university came out
UMass
Amherst, and said, we're not going to hire this guy again. We are looking into this whole thing, and we're doing an investigation, which he acknowledges, by the way. He says you're going to cooperate with this, but we're not going to hire him again. And it makes it clear that the university has these standards, which if true, if the stuff is true, were overridden, right?
We have a lot of letters. I'm just going to go to one or two here, and then I'm going to go to a break, and we'll come back and we'll continue. But John writes, I'm gay, have a PhD, but left academia for my now husband. If I hadn't met my husband and became a professor, I would be paranoid about even being accused of having a relationship with a student, never mind having Grindr hookups with students. Just no. You don't do that. None of the other gay men I know would do this. Morse is in the wrong here. We also go to Frank, who says, I feel most people in general have issues keeping their collective pants on, gender roles aside. And to this, Jeff said, regardless of orientation, if it is against the code of ethics and borderline Title IX, depending upon the circumstances, for a lecturer or professor to date a student, period. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Listening to Darling Side this morning, a reminder that all of the music that we play during the panel is on our playlist. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org. All right, I want to go through these letters. It'll bring us up to the top here, I think, and then we'll move on to other topics. A lot of people weighing in on this, and the letters are kind of all over the place, which I like, so let's go to as many as we can get to. Paul says, I refuse to believe that just 3 weeks before primary, centrist Democrats would conspire with the media to smear and crush a well-liked progressive challenger. Oh, that would be so unlike them. Obviously sarcastic, but there you go.
Alan, I respect your opinion on Richie Neal. I wouldn't know him if I passed him in the street, and you've been constantly speaking highly of him, and I think that's good. But do you not? Do you not concede at least the possibility of he or his campaign coming up with this? I mean, that was one of the first reactions I heard, was how the timing just stinks and seems suspicious.
Well, let me put it this way. I don't think so. You know, all I can tell you is I know Richie Neal. I have interviewed him lots of times, and most WAMCers have heard him and have can make up their own mind as to whether this is a man of bad character. I certainly do not believe it. And as I say, I've been trying to nose around and figure out whether there's any potential truth to that, and I see none of it. So I think, Ira, things tend to happen at the last minute. Somebody is sitting down there, a student is sitting there in this Democratic organization and saying, you know, we've been putting up with this for a long time, and they wouldn't have done it before, but with the exigency that is here right now, and by the way, it wasn't one person, it was an organization that made the statement. So, Ira, you may be right, but I don't think you can hold anybody responsible unless you know something, and I don't know anything of the kind.
I should mention that Alan will be interviewing Richard Neal this morning on Congressional Corner. That's the good news. The bad news is it was recorded on August 6th before any of this broke. It was recorded late last week. So,
and also that we had Alex Morse for the last 3 days.
That's right, at the end of last week. Yes. So there is that. Let's see. Jeff says, regardless of orientation, I think I read that one already, or if I didn't, it seemed very similar. As a very liberal individual, I strongly disagree with Libby's position of moral superiority. Who are you to tell someone to get in a stable relationship? How this gentleman chooses to live his life is his choice. If we are talking about consenting adults, then there is no position of authority, meaning he is actively teaching the student. Who cares? Individuals, I don't know that I understand that.
Huh?
And there is no position of authority, meaning he is actively teaching the student. Oh, and then they're saying, who cares? I get it. Okay. Individuals are allowed to have lives distinct from their careers. What's next? The school crossing guard is obviously in a position of authority. So what she does at home is everyone's business. Very slippery slope you are heading down. I think there's a difference between the school crossing guard and having a relationship with them.
Anybody can have a relationship, as far as I'm concerned. Anybody can have, and I agree with the letter writer, and I love Libby, but I think on that one point, you know, saying, you know, if you want to be mayor, if you want to be congressperson, you should be looking for a stable relationship. Well, maybe not, but not with students. I think that's where the letter writer gets it wrong.
Well, and I took to what you said, Libby, not to put words in your mouth, but just the way I took what you said is that someone, and I think Jennifer made this exact point, was that someone who is a lecturer and mayor should know better.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Someone who's progressive.
So do we bring up Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky?
And look what it cost him.
Well, he should have known better, too.
Absolutely.
But he survived, and he ultimately became one of the most popular presidents in the history of the country. I mean, well, I don't disagree with you. He should have known better. Obviously, it's my recollection that when I was editor of the Freeman, we were one of the first papers in the country to editorialize very critically and suggest he should resign. But, you know, he may have moved the goalposts for those to follow.
And do I have to remind everybody about the Trump trope in which he says, grab them by the you-know-whats and do this right. and do that, and won an election?
Let's see. We'll go to Ruth, who says, for those of us authentic progressives in Western Massachusetts, we may be left only with Richie Neal as a choice for our federal rep, but maybe not an ethical lapse regarding sex, but clearly with a longstanding ethical lapse of favoring his corporate health industry donors, representing them to the detriment of lower drug prices, better health insurance, and fairness in support of Palestinian rights. We do not agree that Richard Neal is one of us. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, he might as well be a Republican. Kate writes, thank you for your thoughtful discourse this morning. I'm continually frustrated by the mentality that the perpetrator gets to decide where there is a victim. Thank you, Joe, for bringing up the college Democrats were uncomfortable. If your behavior makes someone uncomfortable, stop saying you did nothing wrong. Whether gay or straight, we should always listen to the victims. Thank you for reinforcing that message.
You know, that's a great letter, and I'll tell you why. Everybody should go back for themselves. Don't listen to anybody else. Don't listen to me or anybody else. Go back and read what he did. He said, I may have done wrong. People may want to disendorse me. He did all of that. So he's made the case against himself without anybody interfering.
I think the required reading for people interested in this, one is the statement, the original statement from the College Democrats, the statement from Alex Morris that he made yesterday, read that, and then also read the statement that the College Democrats put out as a response to Morris's statement yesterday. Kathy?
So one more thing. We could go back and think about this for a second. Donald Trump was opposed to much of what the Democrats have done in Congress, what the House of Representatives has done. They, you know, the idea that they came out and they gave everybody in America $600 and that Trump refuses to re-up on that. And then consider the fact that it's Richie Neal who wrote the bill. Who wrote the bill but put all of that money on everybody's table, and who wrote the second bill, which is now being debated with the Republicans. Come on. Don't tell me he's not a progressive. He's more progressive than the people. And by the way, Alex Morse, I hate to ask you to say this to you, but when I interviewed him, I said to him, were you against the bill that did all of this? And he said, yes, it wasn't enough. So he would have rather had nothing. And would you have voted against it? Yes, he said.
Wait, I think saying it's not enough is not saying that, right? Saying it's not enough means that 600 really isn't the answer. He's looking for more. He's advocating for people.
That's true. And I asked him, would you have voted against the bill? And the answer was yes. Voted against the bill if you were a congressman.
Did you ask him if he was going to vote for Joe Biden?
I did not.
Okay.
I did ask him whether he was going to vote for Nancy Pelosi, and he hemmed and hawed on that one.
Yeah, he said he would wait to see who was up. All right, I think we have like three letters, so I'm just going to go through this real quick. I recall early 80s being a youth group leader for our church. We were in our 20s. We had a new leader when we began to realize he was seeking social relationships with the youth who were maybe 5-6 years her junior. We knew. We didn't debate. We didn't wonder. We knew her behavior was wrong. She was fired from this volunteer job. The issue is not the age. The issue is the relationship. Also, John says, I'm sorry, but Libby's comments are unbelievably homophobic and anti-male. You cannot say that you support gay liberation and then make a case that a 31-year-old gay man must adopt heterodominant norms of behavior. Everyone is entitled to a private life and make their own sexual decisions, provided they are consensual. Please bring the level of nuance to the issue of homophobia that you bring to the conversation about race and sexism.
Excuse me. We're talking about a man who slept with students as a professor. That's what we're talking about here. And that's the inappropriate behavior. Not the sexual activity, not the fact that he was on Grindr, not the fact that, you know, he's living his life the way he wanted to live it. I don't really care about that. It's about the fact that he was a professor or a lecturer employed by a university and then sleeping with students at that university. It is inappropriate, period.
All right. Just listen to the university. They'll tell you that. They are saying that in their statement.
Wynn says, Libby is correct to condemn Morse's actions. He brought it on himself. We see this all the time. A talented, strong advocate of people goes down by committing stupid personal actions. Where does this unconscious desire for defeat come from? And finally, before we go to a break in news with Ray, did I really hear Libby say men can't just keep it in their pants? Is that not a sexist remark? Am I confused? She just painted the whole gender with one brush.
No, just the ones who can't do it.
not the men who can keep it in their pants. The men who can't keep it in their pants.
On the radio, I'm not sure you can say it much better than that and still stay on the air.
Yeah. I think the letter writer had a point.
All right, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We're going to move on to other subjects, and I think we're all happy for that. So we'll talk about what the president did over the weekend and try to make sense of that. That should take a couple hours. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Ira Fussfeld. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to another story, and the big story over the weekend, which was the executive orders that were signed by the president. Trump's executive orders spark confusion among businesses and state officials as Democrats assail them as unworkable. President Trump's new executive actions to disperse coronavirus relief without congressional approval sparked confusion among just about everyone. Some who had lamented the moves would not deliver the necessary relief to cash-strapped Americans. Trump's directives were aimed at offering new unemployment benefits, protecting renters from eviction, and postponing the payment of a federal tax. But some economists and experts faulted these policies as incomplete or legally questionable, raising the prospect that the president's attempt to boost the economy may have only a muted effect. One of the orders allows employees making less than $104,000 to delay until January payment of a payroll tax that funds Social Security and Medicare. Trump added that he would try to change federal rules next year to make the deferred payments into a permanent tax cut, but only if he is reelected. The tax is typically taken out of paychecks by employers and businesses. Payment processors and economists signaled on Sunday, in the absence of a guarantee that the payroll taxes actually would be absolved, businesses would be unlikely to alter worker paychecks. Meanwhile, there is the matter of the $600 that a week and a half ago expired. That now is $400, with states being asked by the president to put in a quarter or $100, and the states would be required for doing the heavy lifting on that as far as making it so. So if the state opts out, it doesn't mean that you're just going to get $300. It means that you're not going to get anything. So putting the onus on the state, with many state governors saying they simply could not do it. Governor Andrew Cuomo said executive orders can't replace legislative actions. States can't pay 25% of unemployment costs. It's simply impossible. All right. A lot there. Alan, what do you think?
Hysterical. I'll only do this. I mean, this is really funny. I'll only do this if I'm reelected.
Yeah, you do this for me. You do this for me. I'll do this for you.
Yeah. I'll do. Now, the fact of the matter is he can't even make it work. If he were to say, okay, we'll continue with the $600, we'll continue to make this happen, but he won't. So what he's doing is he's throwing in a poison pill throughout these ideas of his. So the poison pill would be that it'll be $400, or the poison pill would be that the states have to pay a quarter of it. So those are the things that he's doing. Meanwhile, the bigger question, obviously, is whether or not our tripartite system of government is at risk here, whether or not a president can unilaterally do all this stuff. Can he end the post office as we know it so that people can't vote? What do you think he's doing? We all understand that. So does he have that power? And that will go to the courts, too.
A lot of confusion over all of these four separate executive orders that were signed at the president's. There's some question as to whether they were even signed. Apparently, it was more of a show for the people who were at the club who were invited to be a part of it. So, Ira, what do you think?
Well, you know, Joe, president on Friday at the golf club had his communications people tell the reporters to put the lid on the rest of the day, meaning there wasn't going to be any other news coming from him and he'd be out of reach. And then later in the day, they abruptly moved to tell the reporters that there was going to be this press conference. This whole thing was slapdash together. And then I sort of picture Trump playing golf on Friday morning, asking somebody from the club, what's going on at the club tonight? Oh, it's surf and turf night. Well, that's good. Let's have something for the members. Sure, they can come down and bring their drinks with them. No need for masks. And then I'm going to unveil with quite a bit of flourish these four major steps that I'm taking, which, surprise, surprise, is just a load of junk that they threw together. And as both Joe and Alan have just pointed out, there are all sorts of holes in this thing. And I also very much agree with Alan that we need to be watching. We need to be keeping our eye on the ball about the democracy and specifically the post office, because that stuff scares me. By the way, I will say one thing, and I need I think Libby and Alan would be able to check me if my memory is correct. Isn't it frequent that states, and New York State is the one I know best, try to drop down responsibilities, financial responsibilities, to the counties and the municipalities, and that one little piece that where he wants the states to pay $100, you know, I think Cuomo and the other governors are crying crocodile tears.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, this is first of all, it reminds me, it's today's version of walking around with a roll of $5 bills in your pocket to buy people's votes. And, you know, I mean, it's a $400 gift for that's never going to happen anyway. But
I was going to say the $5 bills may not be real.
Yeah, right. I mean,
You're right. It's been done. It's been done. Yeah. It used to be called walking around money.
Right, walking around money. You know, and so it's. This $400 thing's never going to happen. None of this is going to happen. You know, what's the real crime here is that, oh, well, the states can pick up this extra money because they haven't really spent the first part of the stimulus money that we gave them. Well, I don't even know if that money has been released by the feds, number one. Number two, what the Democrats in the House are trying to do is get relief for states and localities and local governments. And Steven Mnuchin, you know, was saying the other day, oh, that's preposterous. We don't need to do that. What these people don't seem to understand is if they don't provide support for the states, the whole country is going to go down in flames. The economy is going to tank to a point where it will be very hard to recover from. The states need this help. And the only way, because the state, the government can default, but the federal government can default and run on a deficit, but the states can't. And they have to help. And they don't want to. And, you know, and it's not just it's not just Democratic states. It's Republican states as well.
Jennifer?
Yeah, you know, I think this is requiring or asking, really, trying to force states to then reallocate, move money around. So it means that if they do participate in this to get people a little something, right, in the meantime, that they are going to find a deficit someplace else, whether it goes to the school funding or some other entity that is very much needed. And my other concern about it is, you know, when you add on top of that the housing, issue, right? The eviction moratorium. Mm-hmm. That whole thing right there is also very problematic because essentially he's not really continuing that people can't be evicted. He's essentially saying, like, well, you should be reviewed, right? So there's more paperwork. Like, the state should set up sort of a review to see if money is needed and if it's available and if people then should still be evicted. So giving people less than the $600, especially people who are unemployed, and that $600 for some of them was more than they were regularly making, right? So we're talking, you're dropping them down below what was helpful to get them kind of to a position where they could survive, to now in a position where they're unemployed. Who knows if they'll get a job again? They may be facing eviction or the loss of home, right? But we'll set up a new program to review that. People can tell you that's exactly what they're going to face. $600 was not enough to begin with. The regular pay that we have for Americans is not enough for a healthy standard of living. And it gets even worse when you're talking about minorities.
You know, Ira used the term slapdash a few moments ago, and if anyone wants a definition of that and to see it in real time, they should watch the Larry Kudlow interview with Dana Bash.
It's unbelievable.
It really.
He kept saying, well, this is what he really meant. I mean,
yeah, it's $800, and the state will throw in another $100. And she said, I thought it was $400, and the state, it would be $300, and the state would throw in $100. And he said, no, it's $800. And he said, well, no, $1,200. And she said, I'm sorry, where's the $1,200 coming from? It was really confusing. Jennifer?
Well, and by the way, I don't know if I may have missed it. Someone else has pointed this out, but one, these payroll tax cuts don't do you any good if you're not working, because there's no payroll check that you're going to receive. And then secondly, and equally if not more important, is the negative impact these cuts will have on Medicare and Medicaid.
And Social Security.
Right.
And Social Security, Ira.
And Social Security, yes.
Can you imagine a president of the United States in this year, 2020, talking about basically what will impact or end Social Security, and then he'll come back and say, we don't have enough money to fund the Social Security program. Oh, why? Oh, why? Because I took it away.
Jennifer?
That's exactly what it will be, right? I mean, this really, I think, comes back to Trump's attempt to speak to his base, but then also, you know, separate himself or give more challenges to the Republican Party, because his ultimate goal is to win for Trump, right? And so he can then stand out there and say, well, the Republicans couldn't figure it out and the Democrats couldn't figure it out and they're fighting. So I am the one who has saved everyone.
Mm.
And again, you're taking what is just there because there is nothing else, and it's still going to harm you. But
and it's still the road. It's still the road to dictatorship. That's what he's gotten.
But that's also if he can do it, right? We're not even sure that any of this is legal, and he actually can do it.
It's going to come down to John Roberts. I'm telling you.
Well, and I also thought it was interesting, you know, that he has his White House lawyer saying that he can do it, right? And then he dared the Democrats to sue. Take the White House to court. Here we are again with the lawsuits. That pattern of behavior where people have to spend all of this money and you have to get embroiled in court, right? I mean, this is the M.O.
Nancy Pelosi was on that same show that Kudlow was on, and she wouldn't 100% say it was unconstitutional. She is not sure. So he may well be able to get away with this.
Mm-hmm. But it would still be as far as the money goes. And Alan, let me ask you, just so you're a governor of a state, let's say a Democratic governor of a blue state like Andrew Cuomo in New York, and you say, okay, we're not doing it, we can't do it. So what political pressure does that put on those governors and ultimately to the overall plan?
Now, interestingly, Cuomo in his reaction, correct me if I'm wrong, gang, did not say that. What he said is, if I have to come up with that money, then I'm going to have to take it from somewhere else. And he, in fact, named those somewhere else's. So which will be.
It might have been the governor of Connecticut, but you're right. Cuomo didn't say he wouldn't pay it, but I think the governor of Connecticut said the money that they would have to spend on this, they were going to spend on COVID, cleaning the schools.
Right, he did say that.
Like.
He said it was laughable. What the president has done has made it impossible on the state. The concept of saying to the states you pay 25% of unemployment is just laughable. They need legislation. It's the only way to do it.
But let's not forget that Trump wants to take this money from the disaster relief fund as we're going into what's going to be one of the worst hurricane seasons we've experienced in a very long time. He's paying Peter, he's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yes.
And there are still some places downstate in New York and in Connecticut that don't have power from the last storm that just blew through.
Right.
That's right.
I may stand corrected on the Connecticut versus New York, but I think Cuomo also said some stuff about not having the money. The interesting thing about Cuomo was that we've been talking all along about $16 billion deficit in the – I don't know if you picked this up too, Libby – the $16 billion deficit. And this time when Cuomo was talking, he was talking about $14 billion. Somehow we gained $2
billion. Well, he's holding back 20%. From everybody.
No.
So that he
said we were $16 billion in the hole.
I thought he wanted 30. Is that am I not right?
Yeah,
on
no, because there's another $16 billion somewhere else, but
okay.
He's
all
behind
right.
it. Yeah, but he was has been saying yeah, oh yeah. Well, that's true. You make a good point.
All right. So I'm curious as to let's go to some letters here first, actually. Earl says, Trump's latest effort to appear compassionate by cutting taxes needs to be understood for just what it is, a blatant attempt to run an end around on the Constitution in order to score a talking point prior to the election. Truth is, payroll taxes can't be eliminated without backing by Congress. If he wants to suspend them, it needs to be made clear that the bill will come due December 31st. And people should be aware that payroll taxes are the method we fund two of our most relied upon and trusted programs, Social Security and Medicare. This is just another way to eliminate popular programs and please conservatives who, for decades, have had this in their sights.
It's a brilliant letter. And when you think about it, because that is exactly what he's trying to do. He's saying, okay, it may not be legal, it may not be constitutional, but I'm doing it. Now, you can take me to court and invite people to take them to court if they want to. But so people will say, well, it was the Democrats who stopped us from getting even a little bit there. That's what he's counting on.
Carolyn says, is it possible Trump is trying to bankrupt all the states? He refuses to fund states for any reason, then directs they have to come up with even more money that they don't have.
Well, it'll put everybody on their knees, that's for sure, which is where he likes people. So,
Luigi says, yes, Alan, they are poison pills, but they appear to be in the flavor of supporting the working man. Lower payroll taxes, no evictions, but he's being successful in fooling the voting public, as demonstrated in his rising in the polls.
Well, not rising that much, but I do agree. I think he's right.
And Linda makes a point, I think, that Ira made earlier, that so how will the payroll tax break help the unemployed, which is a good point, of course. Go ahead, Jennifer.
I think the other thing about the payroll tax issue, right, as I understand it, is that this is supposed to be a relief for now. But when it comes tax time, when you're filing your taxes for the 2020 year, you then could find yourself owing taxes.
That's
at
right.
time rather
That's right.
than
it's a deferral.
A tax return check. And that is a very big deal if people are trying to recover a little bit in the 2021 year, right? That you will then have to pay this back, or you will not get any money back in your tax returns because of this relief.
And can you opt out, meaning still have the money taken out, I wonder?
I don't know, because wasn't there quite a bit in the news about if employers would actually go through with this because of the paperwork
Correct.
And the liability
yes.
and all of that? So there's still it's a real, right? So there's all these other weeds to get lost in, but Trump has created.
Yeah. I mean, paychecks, ADP, they've all said this is going to be an impossible thing to implement in such a short period of time. Jennifer's absolutely right. We'll all have to pay it back at some point. me as an employer, I mean, I only have me that I have to worry about, but I'm not going to not pay those my federal taxes, because I know what the feds do when you don't pay your taxes. They come right after you. And so, you know, this is just a shell game. It's all it is.
John writes and says, all of these orders by Trump are just a distraction from the reality of the COVID pandemic. Slate ran an article this morning that documented all of the times and ways Trump mishandled and interfered with protecting the country from the pandemic. Very thorough and condemning piece. And we should note that, I mean, the reason for all of this is supposed to be to offer relief to people who need it during this pandemic. Amanda says, I can't help but think that this discussion regarding Trump's executive order are all for naught, as his intentions were never to fund this, but as a way to say that he helped the country. If the state can't afford this plan, it will be their fault if it doesn't happen. Roy says, is it not the case that employers regularly pay into state unemployment trust funds? Has your state exhausted those funds? I don't know the answer to that. Anyone?
Me neither.
Well, you do pay into the unemployment insurance fund up to a certain point of somebody's salary, and which then goes to help pay for unemployment for your former employees, but also it's a pool that ends up being paid for. I mean, I pay in for myself. I'll never collect unemployment insurance from my business, but my money goes to help pay for somebody else's.
Luca says, so the nation is being financially guided by a master of business bankruptcies. With that history, why is anyone listening? Bud says it doesn't matter whether or not Trump can do what he announced. His base doesn't listen to explanations. They just will hear that Trump will fix things and the Democrats will not. That from our letter writers this morning.
Well, then that's echoed by Rush Limbaugh, and it's echoed by Hannity and the nighttime crew over at Fox. And part of this that's so damn annoying is the short-sightedness of it. In other words, if the government is looking to save money, the government in this case meaning Trump, by cutting some of the obligations that it had already committed to, at some point they're going to have to pay the piper. You can pay now or you're going to pay later. But the more people that are going to go into poverty and unable to pay bills and all of the rest that get evictions, that's going to cost this government at all levels as much, if not more so, going forward. And why they don't want to address it now and why they don't see it now, well, you tell me. I have to think that the election is part of it, because, as Alan said, he will say, look what I did, and the Democrats wouldn't compromise. And that's all he has his eye on right now. He's 2.5 months is as far ahead as he's looking.
But people are dying every single day of COVID.
Without doubt.
That's not going away.
All right.
No, they don't. But the news media don't.
All right. We're going to go to a break. Hey, Libby, I know you're on the app. If you could just disconnect and reconnect, that would be great. You're seizing up a couple times, and you sound like a robot, and I know you don't sound like that in real life. So you do that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up the program. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Ira Fussfeld. We will return right after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion as we wrap up this edition this morning of the panel. I want to talk about a coronavirus. We have not, we've talked around it, but we haven't talked about it generally. And, or specifically, I should say, the number of reported coronavirus cases in the U.S. surpassed 5 million on Sunday, double the number since the end of June, as the Midwest grappled with new spikes and states across the South and West fought to contain surges. The 5 million mark comes just 17 days after the U.S. total exceeded 4 million, according to the Washington Post's tracking. The previous million cases were also reported in about a two-week span. Reported U.S. cases have doubled since late June, peaking on July 17th with a staggering 76,491 cases in a single day. The U.S. leads the world with a quarter of all global infections. Brazil and India follow with 3 million and 2.1 million reported infections, respectively. A couple things to note. A cluster of coronavirus cases has emerged at a Georgia high school that drew national attention last week after students posted pictures and videos of their peers walking without masks in tightly packed hallways, according to a letter sent to parents over the weekend. I believe it was 9 students so far that have tested positive in that case. The U.S. tallied 50,002 coronavirus cases and 579 deaths on Sunday after 5 straight days of death tolls greater than 1,000, according to the Post's tracking. The single-day death totals in Arkansas and Nevada set records, and new deaths were higher than current 7-day averages in Louisiana, Minnesota, Washington, and West Virginia. Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo reported on Sunday that his state, which was hit hard early in the pandemic, logged its lowest positivity rate yet, 0.78% of 65,812 test results submitted to the state on Saturday. The governor said that 515 were positive. So, some of the numbers that we should know about and care about. Who would like to start? Alan?
Well, the New York thing is exemplary. One hopes that it holds up. The governor, I know, having spoken to him about this, is always worried that there'll be a reversal. We have come to the point in America where it used to be, come to my state, come to my state, and spend your money. It's now stay away. And we're setting up literally border patrols to make sure that happens. New York has really had a very tough time of it in the beginning, but now seems to be doing extremely well. And one can only scratch their heads and say, could it all be because every New Yorker is wearing a mask? Or is there something else going on here?
Ira?
You could say, what do you mean something else?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of questions. Ira?
I'm going to give Cuomo a lot of credit, as others have, for the way he handled this thing at the beginning. I think he's become overexposed, but he certainly was the right man to do what he did at the beginning and got New York in line. I'm just more startled by those who are not wearing masks. I mean, we're all annoyed to have to wear them. They're uncomfortable and all the rest, but people are just literally taking their lives and the lives of others in their own hands, and it's frustrating. It borders on criminal, in my view. And then you will see, and I read it in one of the papers today or yesterday. Again, I'll use Rush Limbaugh's name. That's twice in 20 minutes. But he says that the virus is a conspiracy between the liberal media and the Democrats and the people who are following Rush Limbaugh and believe in him, and they are legion, are not wearing masks, many of them, or maybe even most of them. So for all of the good that we've seen in places like New York, It's a disaster still in much of the rest of the country. And let's see how many of those 250,000 people who showed up for that for this motorcycle rally in South Dakota. Let's check the numbers on COVID in the next couple of weeks regarding them.
Concerns that the Sturgis event is the spiking event with 250,000 plus bikers a part of it, that this would be a super spreader event. Obviously, you're not going to know a lot of it until, because people from all over the country are going to this event. I thought it was interesting. They were interviewing people who were there yesterday and last night, and more than a few said that the reason they were there was because they felt like they could take a vacation from wearing a mask and take a vacation from worrying about the virus. And that's a mindset. It's kind of hard to get your mind around, I guess.
Well, and if you want to be morbidly humorous about this, if this is really a plot by the Democrats and the liberal media, and thus those who are not in favor of those two groups are not going to wear masks, then the liberal media and the Democrats should just be patient because a lot of their opponents are going to die soon.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, if we want to see what happens in Sturgis is in 6 to 8 weeks, just scour the the for sale listings to see if there are a lot of motorcycles for sale.
But one can really not be assured that we will ever know how many people were infected at this thing.
I think the other thing here is that when we, you know, if you go to the New York Times, you know, COVID map, if you're watching, right. You know, how they're gathering, you see that both coasts are really where most of the cases are. And it dwindles as you get to the middle of the country. And with the Sturgis rally, as I was trying to watch things about it and listen to people who were being interviewed, many of them come from that Midwest and those middle states, north and south in the country, who are going in. Not that they're not coming from, you know, the coasts as well. They are. But one of the telling thing was people, many of them from like Nebraska and, you know, Minnesota and other places were saying, well, I don't know anybody who's been infected. So for them, it's like they haven't really experienced what so many other people have, which is how COVID, you know, ravages your area. And this rally lasts, what, 10 days? It's not like a two-day thing, which is enough, but 10 days. So you have 10 days of people going in and out and staying and then bringing it, if they get it there, back to wherever they come from or came from. So that middle part of the country that has had lower cases, that we've seen the spike in places like Arizona and everything else, may increase because of this long exposure over 10 days if people are there 4 days or 5 days without masks. That's going to be very telling.
Yes, it will be. And just to see a lot of people and how it spreads. There was some interesting, I also read a piece about how the town itself and even the state work in trying to set up centers and COVID hospitals and have beds prepared. But most people said, okay, but people are going to be home by the time that the virus actually,
exactly.
You know, hits, mm-hmm. if it does, and hopefully it won't. Anybody?
But the local residents there will
yes.
need this. They
yes.
May
well,
need
that's
this.
Very true. Yeah.
For
absolutely.
Sure.
Yes. All right. Anybody else on that?
Well, only I want to return, if I can, Joe, yes. for a second to the idea of these boundaries that we now are setting up everywhere. In my little town of Great Barrington, I wrote a column very early saying, hey, if people were going to come up here and stay in their second homes, that was great. And boy, did I get it. Boy, did I catch it. And now governors are saying you have to self-quarantine if you come from certain states. So my kid can't come from South Carolina. Excuse me, from Louisiana to Great Barrington. And if he did, he and his son would have to be quarantined for 14 days and before they went back and quarantined again. There is this business now of setting up these boundaries, which is so depressing.
Absolutely.
With no end in sight. Even if there is a vaccine sooner than later, it's going to take months, many months, for people to be vaccinated and to be certain that it works and all of the rest. Mm. I just think people who are counting on us not being talking about this time next year are overly optimistic.
Super Fauci says 2021.
Yeah.
Well, at what time in 2021?
I think he's
right after the first of the year or before Christmas.
Well said, Ira. Well said.
Well, and I still want to get back to this because I think, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about this, I think, over the next couple of weeks. We already have been talking a lot about this, but, you know, school is here and the governor made his announcement on Friday. That schools will open, but it's up to the schools and the districts and the parents and the teachers and the administrators to come to some common ground. It seems very mixed, and I just the whenever I have this conversation with people, it just seems a little like, what are you going to do? And most parents are very concerned about sending their kids back to school, and I find that. Obviously, it's troubling, but I don't know, as we mentioned in the rundown just a moment ago about the case in Georgia where they sent kids back, the schools were crowded. nine kids now have.
Well, you know it's going to happen. You right. know it.
Right. Well, it is. And so do you just let it play out, or do you try to prevent it from happening?
Well, it seems to me that the one thing that some of the schools are doing is putting as many fail-safe mechanisms in place as they possibly can. You know, so they're taking temperatures when people come in, or they come into the schools, or they're, you know, putting the desks at 6 feet places. And
yeah.
But somebody's going to still get it. And then what do? Do you close down the whole school? What do?
Well, even if you accept the fact that the children are more likely to be immune from this disease, which is not 100% correct, but there's certainly less disease as among the student population, what does that mean to the teachers and the staff and the administrators who are all going to be exposed to it? I mean, we can't visit our grandchildren, their school-aged kids, because, you know, they pass it along to us, that my wife and I at our ages. You mean to tell me that same risk doesn't apply to teachers and staff and administrators?
And we also know that, despite what the president said, that the kids are immune to it, they're not, and they do get it, and that's of concern as well. The numbers may be very low, but it doesn't mean that they're not.
We are certainly learning that now. Statistically, we are learning that.
All right.
That's changing right now as we speak, because we saw the spike in summer camps in Missouri and in Georgia.
Yep.
We've seen kids go back to school in Georgia while they still had, you know, they were on the upswing here in cases. And so we're seeing a spike in the schools, in certain schools, we'll say. But the other thing I think that we need to pay attention to is the side effect for children, because what is also on the rise is the hospitalizations and the deaths when it comes to that multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, right? That it's a side effect of having COVID. And that is something not brand new, but getting more attention right now because kids are getting together more and more in school and in camp environments. So that right there will be another one of these problems that's going to play out in the next couple of weeks.
Great point. We are out of time. I want to thank all of you for being with us this morning. Alan, thank you very much, as always.
Thanks, Joe.
Appreciate it. Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Ira Fussfeld, thank you. We are going to continue.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. We're going to continue our program, and we will be back with the Congressional Corner and Richie Neal right after this.